The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
Great to see you here. Let me ask you a question and see how your memory is. Can you remember, and actually this is quite a sad day, and I know when I tell you what happened this day, you will remember. Can anyone remember April 29 last year and what happened? No, I wouldn't have remembered either, I had to check. It's the day when Andrew Chan and Murian Sukumaran were executed in Indonesia. And you remember, that was a huge thing in the media, and it kind of divided the community as well. There were some people who said, well, this is justice and it needs to happen and don't have sympathy for them. But I think the majority of people said, no, it's too harsh, sure they're guilty, but, you know, it doesn't allow for their contrition, they're only young men. But regardless of who was commenting, no one said that was a good day. No one. And my guess is the media will remember it this year as well. No one said it was a good day. And yet, there's a strange thing that next week, on Friday, our whole nation will stop. Whether you're a Christian or not, you take a public holiday, everyone does. And on Friday, we'll remember what we call Good Friday, which remembers the execution of another young man who pretty much everyone agrees was innocent. Now, how do you get from the execution of an innocent young man to Good Friday? That's what I'd like to try and answer this afternoon. We're trying to understand what it is, what's Easter all about, how do you make sense of it, why is Good Friday a good day to remember? Okay, how to do that? Well, I know on Tuesday when I was trying to work out this talk, I went to my library and I pulled out every book that I had on Easter or the death of Jesus, stacked them up, and because I'm trying to work, I literally added up, it was more than 1,000 pages. Now, I've read some of them. But I thought, how do you turn, what do you say in 20 minutes? And, okay, as simple and clear as I could be, did it happen and what does it mean? Did it happen and what does it mean? I probably spend more time on what does it mean, because almost no historians doubt that Jesus existed, died. Well, let me show you why we know that sort of thing. The New Testament witness is very strong. But even outside of the New Testament, historians like the Roman historian Tacitus, Tacitus lived from about 56 AD to 117 AD. He wrote more than 30 different books. Perhaps his most famous one is the Annals of Imperial Rome. There's a section of it, and I own the little section, it's about 60 pages, Nero and the Burning of Rome. When Tacitus wrote that, he's about as far away from the life of Jesus, the burning of Rome, for example, as we are from the Second World War. The Great Fire of Rome happened in about the year 64. But listen to what Tacitus says as he tries to explain why the Great Fire of Rome, or the furor around the Great Fire, and what he tells us in passing. Here we are. He says, why was there trouble in Rome at the time of the Great Fire? For a rumour had spread that while the city was burning, Nero had gone to his private stage and, comparing modern calamities with ancient, had sung of the destruction of Troy. So you know the story of Nero fiddled while Rome burned? No, he didn't. He did karaoke, okay? He sang songs. For people believed that Nero was ambitious to found a new city to be called after himself. So what did Nero do? To suppress this rumour, Nero fabricated scapegoats and punished with every refinement the notoriously depraved Christians, as they were popularly called. Their originator, Christ, had been executed in Tiberius' reign by the governor of Judea, Pontius Pilate. There you go. There's the Christ, or Jesus, executed while the emperor Tiberius reigned by the governor of Judea, Pontius Pilate. Interesting that, well, look at what he says. But in spite of this temporary setback, the deadly superstition had broken out afresh, not only in Judea where the mischief had started, but even in Rome. All degraded and shameful practices collect and flourish in the capital. Interesting, within 30 years of Jesus, so this is 64, within 30 years of Jesus' crucifixion, as he tells us, there's enough Christians in Rome to be blamed or scapegoated for the fire. And so something happened that Christianity exploded across the ancient world. You might want to think about why. What was the initial cause that made that happen? Now, there's other non-Christian references as well. So, for example, the Talmud, the Jewish writings after the fall of Jerusalem, mention that Jesus was hanged, actually hanged on a tree, on Passover Eve. So we can put together the pieces. If you're interested to read more about how we know what we know about Jesus, let us know. I can, or someone who works at City Bible Forum, give you a kind of a clear introduction in terms of the little book to read. So, did it happen? Yes. But what does it mean? So you can see a particular event, but not necessarily understand what it means or what's happening or who's to blame. I'll give you just a quick example. I've always wanted to own a phone booth. If you're under 30, phone booth used to be like these kind of little buildings that they had on street corners with telephones in them, and you would step into them and drop your coins in and make a phone call. So years ago, as a young guy in the building we were living, there was a carpenter with telephones, it was called then. And I got to tell him, I love a phone booth in the corner with a phone. And he said, well, actually, we've got them at work. What we are doing is literally putting a forklift under these phone booths and ripping them out, these old red wooden phone booths. And so they come out of the ground with wires hanging off them, with the feet of the thing bent, with sometimes with dirt on them. He said, if you bring a box trailer, I'll give you one. I'm organised to have one. So, okay, so I borrow a trailer and drive out, and then he literally gets the phone booth put onto the box trailer lying down. I would throw up the ropes over it, tighten it up, and so I'm driving home with this red phone booth with the phone still in it. Like, it was still kind of free, had everything except the customer in it. And then there's wires hanging out of the bottom of the phone booth, and the feet of the phone booth are bent and like. And so I'm sitting at the lights like this, and this guy drives up beside me, and he goes, leans in the window and says, mate, you'll never get away with it. And then drives off. And I say, but you don't, so you can see, and you get the picture. Unless someone tells you what's going on, you don't always get it. Okay, how do we make sense of it? If you want to understand the death of Jesus, the place to start is to understand that Jesus was fundamentally a first century Jewish man who'd been brought up eating, living, breathing the Old Testament. So the Old Testament is the canvas that the life of Jesus is painted on, and Jesus has an understanding of who he is and what he's doing. Now the Old Testament has so many different ways of looking at that, but let me just show you two of the most important. The first one that's really important, if you want to understand why it is that Jesus dies, and his understanding, is the Passover. I don't know if you know much about that, but Jewish people still celebrate the Passover. About, very quickly, if you want to read about this, it's not hard, it's in the book of Exodus. I'll put on your program. It's Exodus chapter 12, we're told about it. Essentially, about 1800 BC, the family of Jacob, or also known as Israel, moved to Egypt. He and his 12 sons and their family, over the next 400 years, they turn into a great nation, and the Egyptians turned into slaves. About 1400 BC, God sends Moses to say to Pharaoh, let my people go. Pharaoh says, effectively, you're dreaming. They're my workforce. We can't live without them. And then begins an arm wrestle between the God of the Bible and Pharaoh. Not really an arm wrestle, it's kind of one-sided. And God sends 9 different plagues on Egypt to break the will of Pharaoh so that he'll let the people go. The 10th plague is the most terrible of all, and it is terrible. The 10th plague is that every firstborn son in every house will die on a particular night. And the Israelites are told by Moses there's only one way that they'll escape that terrible judgment of God, and that is they're to take a lamb on the first of a particular month. And the Israelite or the Hebrew calendar worked on the moon, which is why the dates of Easter change. You might want to talk about that in question time. First of the month, they take the lamb. 14th of the month, which means the full moon, they're to kill the lamb. And what were they to do? They were to put the blood of the lamb on the doorposts or the lintel of where they lived. Doorposts and lintel. And they were told this. The blood will be a sign for you on the houses where you are. And when, God speaking through Moses, and when I see the blood, I will pass over you. Hence the word pass over. And no destructive plague will touch you when I strike Egypt. So the lamb would die, and its blood, which really symbolises life in the Old Testament, its life would be poured out, and the blood would keep those, if you like, underneath that, safe from the angel of death. And they're told that from then on, year by year, they're to celebrate this and remember how God redeemed them, the idea of bought them out or ransomed them out of Egypt and saved them. In fact, Jewish people still celebrate the Passover. And Jesus identifies very strongly, in fact, the New Testament says Jesus is our Passover lamb. And Jesus arranges to be at Jerusalem exactly at Passover time. He dies as the Passover lambs are dying that year. So Passover, and then the second one would be the sacrificial system in the law of Moses. What do I mean? Well, Moses brings the people out of Egypt. They're brought into the promised land by Joshua, finally, many years later. And God is aware that they'll do the wrong thing. They will be guilty. They'll sin, is the Bible's word, and deserve to be punished because they disobeyed God. And God instituted a way of them looking for or finding forgiveness. It's in the book of Leviticus. I'll put in your program there some of the chapters. Leviticus is a difficult and complicated book, and it's meant to be. It's meant to show them that it's costly to live in the presence of a holy, separate God. What were they to do? Well, they were, if you were guilty, you were to bring an animal with you, an animal without blemish. It could be a bull or a goat or a lamb, depending on how wealthy you were, really. The ordinary people bought a lamb. And they're guilty, the lamb is innocent. They were to bring this animal with them to the temple where God had promised to be in the Old Testament. And they were to put their hand on the head of the animal. You were to lay your hand on the head of the burnt offering, and it will be accepted on your behalf to make atonement for you. I can't see where Leviticus ever spells out in absolute detail what the hand on the head meant. But I'm sure it means that they identify somehow that their guilt was carried by the innocent animal, the innocent lamb. And then the lamb is killed, and its blood, or blood symbolic of life, is poured out. And you notice he's saying, if you do this, it'll make atonement. The idea of paying a price or a penalty for wrong that's been done. And the Old Testament, Moses promised, or God promised through Moses, that if they did this again and again, as they did this, they'd be forgiven. If they did it with the right heart, the right attitude towards God. What's interesting is, when you get to the New Testament, the book of Hebrews tells us that the blood of bulls or goats, just animals that have been killed, will never take away sin. You can't be forgiven because an animal dies for you. So how does that work? Well, for 1,300, 1,400 years, all of those sacrifices look forward to one sacrifice that truly actually worked when God takes my guilt and your guilt and places that on his lamb who dies in our place. Now, who's his lamb? Well, I think you can start to join the dots. When it comes to Jesus' own understanding of what he's doing, when you read the Gospels, way more concerned about Jesus' death and those last few days of his life than a normal biography. Maybe a third of each of the Gospels is about the last few days and the last few hours of Jesus' life, and then explaining his death. Luke tells us that Jesus walked 100 kilometres from chapter 9 through to 19, deliberately arriving in Jerusalem exactly before Passover time. Jesus only left us with what the theologians call sacraments. It just means signs, or I suppose you call them religious ceremonies if you wanted to. One was baptism, the idea of being spiritually washed because you trusted him. And the other one that he left us with, the Lord's Supper, or communion, or the Eucharist. So there's lots of different names for it. And that remembers his death, his body broken, his blood poured out. So, not in a morbid way, Jesus focuses on his death as a kind of a, it's his mission. He's come to do this. Now, if you have a look at your program, I've got a quote from Mark's Gospel, and Jesus has an explanation of what it is he's come to do. In context, James and John, who are followers of Jesus, have come to him. Actually, Matthew's Gospel tells us it was their mum that bought them. Very believable. Their mum's brought them along and to ask, do they have the best and most important jobs in Jesus' kingdom? And Jesus says, you guys don't know what you're asking. And then the others had their nose out of joint because James and John thought of it first. Look at Mark 10:42. Jesus called them, his disciples, together and said, you know that those who are regarded as rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their high officials exercise authority over them. In other words, those who have authority use it for their own benefit and push people around. Verse 43, not so with you. He said, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant. And whoever wants to be first must be slave of all. Not only great in Jesus' kingdom, follow him means put the needs of other people ahead of your own. Not easy. Why should you do that? Well, here's the great example, verse 45. For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many. He didn't come for people to serve him, he came to serve us, and notice, to give his life as a ransom for many. Now today, if we use the word ransom, what do you think of? Sorry?
Kidnappers,
yes, well done. That's right, kidnapping. You know, so you got someone rich and their son or daughter gets grabbed, and then do you call the police or not? And what happens to the plot that's launched hundreds of movies? Okay. It's actually pretty similar in the way the New Testament thinks. The word ransom, it's the idea of, well, let me show you what, here's Jesus' words, right? It's a ransom for many. Leon Morris, Australian man, very famous and great scholar of the Bible. Unfortunately, he's died. But in his book about how the apostles preached about Jesus, he says this, on this same word that Jesus uses for ransom, that's the word lutron. It's plain the word was one in common use and that its connection with the release from captivity was well known. When anybody heard the Greek word lutron, or ransom, in the first century, it was natural for him or her to think of the purchase money for manumitting slaves. Now, if you've gone through today and you haven't learned anything new, here's your chance. Ready? Okay. Manumitting. Anyone want to guess what that might mean? I had to look it up on Google. It means releasing slaves. Okay, so follow that away, that's definitely worth points in Trivial Pursuit or something. Manumitting slaves. So the idea would be that you would get the money together and pay the price to set someone free from slavery, to ransom them out of slavery. And you might think, well, what's that got to do with us? The answer is that Jesus thought we're slaves to sin. Naturally, by nature, we run from God, we ignore him, we disobey him, we find ourselves doing the things we wish we didn't do and not being able to do the good that we know we should, and it's a struggle, and Jesus says he's come to set us free from that, to be able to forgive us and give us a fresh start and change our hearts so that we actually want to serve God. Did you notice the idea of being set free from slavery, but at a price? And so, what's the price idea? What is it that Jesus pays? Well, here's a quote from the New Testament, a letter written by Peter, one of Jesus' followers, written to Christian people, those who've begun to follow Jesus, and he says this in chapter 1. He says, for you know that it was not with perishable things, such as silver or gold, and not with money, cash, valuables, that you were redeemed, and the word there, redeemed, that's the verbal form of the word Jesus used for ransom. Okay, so you could say, it's not with silver and gold that you were ransomed from the empty way of life handed down to you from your ancestors. Life's empty, they've been ignoring God. What was the price for them being redeemed or ransomed? He says, it wasn't silver or gold, but with the precious blood of Christ, a lamb without blemish or defect. Now, can you see how, once you begin to understand what the Old Testament sacrificial system was about, you know, hand on head, guilt, the innocent one carries the guilt, the lamb dies, you can be forgiven. It's saying all of those lambs really pointed to the one true Lamb of God, Jesus, who dies in our place. And that's the price that's been paid. So, an unspeakably high price, an unspeakable act of love from God to give his son so that we can be forgiven. And not only is there that price paid and forgiveness won, but on the Sunday morning, Jesus rose from the dead to show that he had paid the price, that he had won this victory, and he rose from the dead to show that he really is the Son of God. And that's why he's transformed the world. And billions of people have been able to, well, it's a little bit clumsy, the reset thing. What is it that Jesus' death and resurrection offers? It's the ability to start again. The ability to be forgiven and have a fresh start with God. Not that we've earned it, but a whole kind of, it's the gift of a generous God. All you need to do is reach out and accept the pardon. And you might think, well, this is kind of a no-brainer. Who wouldn't accept that? Why would anyone not say yes? And let me show you an interesting thing that I found a while ago. I've actually tracked it down on the net. I've been told this story, and I was a little sceptical of it because it's so strange. But I get on Google, US Supreme Court records. It's there. It's also on Wikipedia, but I guess the Supreme Court record is probably a little more reliable. In 1833, there was a court case, United States versus George Wilson. Now, George Wilson had been convicted of robbing a mail train and also of murder, and he was sentenced to death. Now, I don't know why, but he was pardoned by President Andrew Jackson. Andrew Jackson wrote the pardon. The pardon was granted. But the strange thing was that Wilson wouldn't accept it. I've read elsewhere that he tore it up and threw it on the floor of his cell. I don't know. We're not told why. I didn't get to check out enough to find out why, whether or not it was he felt like he didn't deserve it, was it his way of kind of pushing the finger to the authorities, or what was it? Don't know. But then the court case came about, well, what if there was a pardon that wasn't accepted? And here's what the Supreme Court said. A pardon is a deed to the validity of which delivery is essential, and delivery is not complete without acceptance. It may then be rejected by the person to whom it is tendered. And if it is rejected, we have discovered no power in this court to force it upon him. Therefore, Wilson was hanged. That's strange. That's why I thought, no, sure, but it seems legit. Why? Because he wouldn't accept. And what does that mean? Well, he would have had to humble himself, to admit that he was guilty, to humble himself to be forgiven, and to be thankful. Now, I wonder sometimes, does that get in the way of people accepting God's pardon? That we need to admit that we need to be forgiven, we need to admit that we're, as Jesus said, slaves to sin, to be thankful and to acknowledge Jesus as our Lord and Master. But it's right there. God's reset, God's forgiveness is freely available if you reach out and take it. Lachlan, I think we have a little bit of time.
Thanks for that, Al.
We do have time for a few questions. We've had a couple that have come in. There's a couple that are about slavery that we might jump straight into.
Yeah. Can I just say, if anybody wants to ask a question old school, like, you know, about this, I'm more than happy. That's the most fun I reckon, but SMS is okay. All right, shoot, Lachlan.
Okay. I feel pretty free. In what sense am I a slave?
Okay. Jesus is saying if you disobey God, and he says this in John chapter 8, if you disobey God and continue to do that, you're a slave to that. And so I put it, yes, you're pretty free, but you actually find that you will inevitably walk away from God, disobey him, and that will control your life. Mm-hmm. And so I've said to thousands of people, said to 100 this week, if you're the person who lives exactly by your own moral code and you never break your own conscience, come and tell me. No one ever has. We can't live up to even our own moral code. That's the kind of slavery. And I think Jesus is saying he'll set us free. He'll take us out of that slavery and give us freedom in serving him. That's just kind of an irony, really. You're either a slave to sin or you're a slave to Jesus. Jesus just says, come serve me and you'll find freedom. It's kind of a paradox. Yeah.
Yeah, so that's a good segue to the next question. So is being a slave a good thing or a bad thing based on what Jesus says?
Is being a slave a good thing or a bad thing? I mean, it probably depends on who your boss is. Was it Bob Dylan said, you know, whoever you are, I can't remember the words exactly, whoever you are, you're going to serve someone. And you will. I think in the Bible's terms, everyone serves or worships something or someone. You will. It's just the way we wire up. And it's when we serve or live for things other than God, they'll never take the weight that we put on them. They never quite deliver. It's actually once you've served the true God that you can enjoy these other things more, because they're not the ultimate things.
Do you have to be baptised to be saved?
Do you have to be baptised to be saved? No. Being baptised is good and a good symbol, yeah? But the guy who is most guaranteed of going to heaven in the New Testament is the thief on the cross at the end of Luke's Gospel. And Jesus says to him, today you'll be with me in paradise. And he died 5 minutes later and he never got baptised. Okay? In 1 Corinthians chapter 1, the Apostle Paul says he can't even remember who he baptised. At the same time, baptism is a really good symbol of a commitment to Jesus, of being spiritually washed, or if you like, kind of buried with him and raised with him. So, yeah, if you become a Christian, great thing to do, to be baptised.
We've got some more questions, but if there's any follow-ups from the audience out here. Yeah, yep.
Why does the ransom need to be met? Couldn't he just forgive us? Oh, that's a beautiful question. Yeah, why couldn't God just forgive us? Okay. If someone had done a terrible crime, like murder, domestic violence, child abuse, and they appear before a judge, and the judge says, well, you know, I'm a pretty compassionate guy, it's okay, plead out. Slate's wiped clean. There would be an outcry. Why? Because we expect a judge to be just. I'll speak with all reverence and carefully. At the heart of the Christian message is kind of like God's dilemma or problem, and that is this, that God is a judge who cares, and he cares how we act, and he cares how we treat him and each other, and God says he'll hold us accountable. Justice. And at the same time, God longs to be able to be forgiving and compassionate and to kind of wipe the slate clean, right? to forgive. And how can you be just and hold people, like, that wrong needs to be punished, but also be compassionate? It's that the judge pays the penalty himself. And that is why the cross is necessary. The cross finds, the death of Jesus finds its origin in the character of God. That God is just and God is compassionate, and so God himself pays that penalty. And you can see how great the wrongdoing is by the price that Jesus pays. That's why he can't just forgive. But that's why that offer is so special. It's like it's a free offer to us, but it costs God so much. Does that make sense? It's such a cliche way to say that's God's dilemma that he solves, and can only be through the cross. It's like when you pull me up, won't you, minute?
Yeah, yep.
It's when in the Garden of Gethsemane on the night before Jesus dies, Jesus prays and asks God to take the cup from him. He prays that he might not have to suffer. Okay? But he says to the Father, whatever your will is, I'll do it. And so what he's saying, is there any other way that this... And the answer is no, there's no other way. So if there was any other way, we could be good enough, or if we had, it's the only way in which God could forgive and rescue, redeem or ransom people. And that's the bleeding heart of the Christian faith, if you like.
Great question. Any follow-ups? Okay, we've got one more.
One more.
If we need to understand the Old Testament to understand Jesus' death, do we need to explain the Old Testament to friends, families and colleagues before we tell them about Jesus?
No, but it helps.
Okay.
let me show you something. I think I can go back. Actually, by the way, have you noticed, I pulled this off the web and I thought, oh, yeah, presidential pardon, United States. When I look at it, it says the disgruntled states of America, not the United States of America. So anyway, we'll change that before we make the mini-series. Okay, let's have a look at this. If you just picked up your New Testament and you read this, you can understand it, okay? For it's not with perishable things such as silver or gold you redeem from the empty way of life, but with the blood of Christ, a lamb without blemish or death. You can understand it, okay? You can even tell a child, Jesus died so that we can be forgiven and be friends with God. 5-year-old can understand that. But if you just had a 20-minute talk on Leviticus and the sacrificial system and hands on heads and the animals dying, which you just did, okay, how much more sense does that make? Christ, a lamb without blemish or defect. Oh, I get it. All those sacrifices, the guilt on the he carries it. And then, okay. So as you understand the Old Testament more, and I don't think I fully understand it, there's a lot of depth there. But as you understand the Old Testament more and more, it's like the picture of what's going on becomes 3D or from black and white to colour. And that's why it's worth trying to work hard at the Old Testament. The Old Testament gives you, while it's not essential to grasp the fundamentals at all, as you understand the Old Testament more, it gives you the categories in which to understand Jesus and his actions and what he's doing.
Mm.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.